This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Modern Manners, an etiquette book for rude people. Written by P.J. O'Rourke. Performed by James Edward Thomas. Introduction. Manners. Why have the things at all? The modern world is a horrid place. It lacks anything enduring and true. It is devoid of every tenable value. All existence is in disarray. Religious beliefs are no longer believed. Love is much discussed but little practiced. Morals are in confusion when they are in evidence at all. And intellect is no consolation. Modern intelligence has become well-nigh unintelligible. Given that life is such a mess, why should anyone care which fork is for the oysters? And yet this may be the only thing we can care about. Just as cleanliness becomes more important at moments when godliness is not possible, so manners come to the fore when more august forms of authority collapse. When substance is execrable, we must make form do the work of content. The world is going to hell. All we can do is look good on the trip. Section 1. Rules to live by in a world with no rules. Oh, let us love our occupations, bless the squire and his relations, live upon our daily rations, and always know our proper stations. Charles Dickens. 1. What are manners? In my mind, there is nothing so illiberal and so ill-bred as audible laughter. Lord Chesterfield. Manners are a way to express altruism in daily life. Either that, or manners are a way to screw people over without their knowing it. Anyway, manners are what your mother always wanted you to have. Whether your mother is a noble idealist or a scheming bitch is something that must be decided by you. How can good manners be identified? Good manners are a combination of intelligence, education, taste, and style mixed together so that you don't need any of those things. Good manners have a number of distinctive qualities. First, they can be learned by rote. This is a good thing. Otherwise, most rich men's daughters could not be displayed in public. Secondly, manners do not vary from culture to culture or place to place. The same polite behavior that makes you a welcome guest in the drawing rooms of Kensington is equally appropriate among the mud people of the fierce Orokiva tribe of Papua New Guinea if you have a gun. This is the advantage of Western-style manners. Citizens of westernized countries still have most of the guns. Another distinctive quality of manners is that they have nothing to do with what you do, only how you do it. For example, Karl Marx was always polite in the British Museum. He was courteous to the staff, never read with his hat on, and didn't make lip farts when he came across passages in Hegel with which he disagreed. Despite the fact that his political exhortations have caused the deaths of millions, he is today more revered than not. On the other hand, John W. Hinckley Jr. was only rude once, to a retired Hollywood movie actor, and Hinckley will be in a mental institution for the rest of his life. How do good manners work? Manners exist because they are useful. In fact, good manners are so useful that with them you can replace most of the things lacking in modern life. Good manners can replace religious beliefs. In the Episcopal Church, they already have. Etiquette and quiet, well-cut clothing is devoutly worshipped by Episcopalians. Good manners can replace morals. It may be years before anyone knows if what you are doing is right. But if what you are doing is nice, it will be immediately evident. Senator Edward Kennedy, for instance, may or may not be a moral person, but he is certainly a polite one. When Miss Kopechne seemed to be in trouble, Senator Kennedy swam all the way to Edgartown rather than run up a stranger's phone bill calling for help. You should be the same way yourself. If you happen to be on a sinking ship with too few lifeboats, take one and slip quietly away. There's going to be a terrific fuss among the drowning passengers, and it's rude to deliberately overhear an argument which is none of your concern. Good manners can also replace love. Most people would rather be treated courteously than loved, if they really thought about it. Consider how few knifings and shootings are the result of etiquette as compared to passion. And good manners can replace intellect by providing a set of memorized responses to almost every situation in life. Memorized responses eliminate the need for thought. Thought is not a very worthwhile pastime anyway. Thinking allows the brain, an inert and mushy organ, to exert unfair domination over more sturdy and active body parts, such as the muscles, the digestive system, and other parts of the body you can have a lot of thoughtless fun with. Thinking also leads to theories, and theoretical correctness is always the antithesis of social correctness. How much better history would have turned out if the Nazis had been socially correct instead of true to their hideous theories? They never would have shipped all those people to concentration camps in boxcars. They would have sent limousines to pick them up. Thinking is actually rude in and of itself. Manners involve interaction with others. You cannot, for instance, think and listen to what other people are saying at the same time. And what most people have to say doesn't merit much thought. So if you are caught thinking, you really have no excuse. As a result of thinking's innate rudeness, thinking people are not often popular. Although the Curies were extremely famous, they were rarely invited out socially. They were too thoughtful. Also, they glowed. The fact that good manners require interaction is finally their most useful trait. Manners force us to pay attention to the needs, desires, and hopes of other people. If you have good manners, you will never become narcissistic and self-obsessed. A self-obsessed person is to be pitied. There are so many interesting people in the world, and while he's not paying attention to them, they will probably rob and cheat him. 2. Creating a persona. The polite you. How dreary to be somebody, how public like a frog, to tell your name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog. Emily Dickinson. In order to know how to act, you must first know who you are. Very few people know who they are. And small wonder, since most people aren't anybody at all. You, for instance, are probably no one in particular. This is because of your dull family. Boring people with humdrum backgrounds were bound to raise a very ordinary you. A compelling persona is inherited. Our behavior is determined by our ancestors. This is a grim statement, and fortunately, a false one. If our behavior were really determined by our ancestors, we'd all act like amoebas. We'd eat by osmosis and reproduce by division, meaning we'd smear food all over our bodies at dinner and have sex by throwing ourselves under a train. In truth, it is no more necessary to go through life with the family you were born into than it is to wear diapers to your debutante ball. You can modify your family to suit your need for an interesting background and alter all your relatives so that you will inherit a fascinating personality from them. You can do this by the simple expedient of lying. Thank God manners have nothing to do with the facts. Your new family. Accompanying this chapter is a family tree you can adopt as your own. This genealogical history will give dignity to a rich person, breeding to a poor one, and if used with wit and style, will make even a middle-class person socially acceptable. Read the instructions carefully. Practice on sympathetic strangers. By the time you get done telling lies about who you are, you will have learned the truth about how you should act. How to use your new family. To produce a truly interesting you, your ancestors should be varied and colorful types. The 10 most important of these types are: Number 1, exotic. Number 2, blue-blooded. Number 3, famous. Number 4, tainted with an awful secret. Number 5, venerable. Number 6, artistic. Number 7, sinful. Number 8, rich. Number 9, bad. Number 10, trendy. The attached genealogical chart provides you with one of each, plus three optional subtypes: mysterious, crazy, and tragically dead. Number 1, Princess Dogfeather, a Carib Indian, one of the few survivors of that nearly extinct tribe. A seafaring member of your family married her on the island of Dominica and brought her back to Massachusetts. The local rumor was that she never fully abandoned her native cannibalism. Indeed, a number of neighborhood children did disappear, but the New Bedford authorities were never able to prove anything. Exotic ancestors are mostly good for cocktail party small talk, but you can also use them to explain cheap jewelry or an ill-conceived hairstyle. They will also go a long way toward excusing a bad accent if you have the nerve to claim some Carib was still spoken in your childhood home. Number 2. Lord Charles Hogford, younger son of Viscount Uttershire and later Duke of Ohio. The more democratic a society becomes, the more people swoon for a title. Otherwise, the Earl of Lichfield would be dragging a pony in an old speed graphic through the suburbs of Liverpool, taking toddler snaps. Unfortunately, there are only two ways for an American to get a title. Either marry one, if you're a woman, or be made a papal count, if you're a man and a Catholic and a total humbug. Therefore, you have to invent something. Let it drop that if Cornwallis hadn't been such a wimp at Yorktown, you might have a ducal estate in downtown Akron today. But don't overplay your hand. Universal love of titles is matched by universal hatred of inherited social status. Make your noble progenitor a debt-plagued wastrel. Say he was exiled to America and George II created him Duke of Ohio in hopes that he would go to that distant place and never find his way home. Number 3. Senator Henry Clay. Fame is even more valuable than nobility, and its standards are lower. In fact, there are none. A very quiet and tasteful way to be famous is to have a famous relative. Then you can not only be nothing, you can do nothing, too. This is the Alice Roosevelt Longworth kind of fame. Anyway, pick a famous ancestor who's obscure enough and dead enough so you won't be caught out. And don't brag about him. You should deprecate his character just as you should deprecate your own. Remember the wisdom of Dr. Johnson, who said, "All censure of a man's self is oblique praise. It is in order to shew how much he can spare." Point out that Henry Clay helped to provoke the stupid war of 1812, threw a fix into the election of John Quincy Adams, and by his authorship of the Missouri Compromise, proved himself a poltroon on the slavery question. Number 4. Marcus Aurelius Jackson. Born a slave, later the wealthiest barber in Cairo, Illinois. Nothing makes an awful secret like a secret Negro. A secret like this allows you to act moody, resentful, guilty, depressed. In other words, allows you to act like everyone else, except you have an excuse. It's also great for seduction, especially down south. Tearfully confess that your family has been hiding this for 150 years. The object of your desire will reciprocate immediately. All Southern families have been hiding something for 150 years, and nothing sparks an affair like shared paranoid psychosis. Up north, confess your bloodline freely. There's nothing a northerner likes better than a black person who is completely white. Do not, however, try this trick with real blacks. They could give a shit. Incidentally, if you happen to be black, this relative will explain your color, and you can still have all the white ancestors, too. American blacks carry a lot more patrician blood in their veins than the sheet-draped yahoos who want to chase them off school buses. If you travel in very sophisticated circles, you may want to turn Marcus Aurelius into Moses Schmeckle. Racism is very lower class. Upper class people are never racists. They're anti-Semites. Number 5. Luther Burbank, your last name. Grandfather on your father's side. It's important to have someone intelligent, educated, and morally outstanding in the family. It impresses potential in-laws and gives your lawyer something to work with when he's trying to get you sentenced to a minimum security federal tennis prison. Make Grandfather Luther a graduate of Stanford. Harvard is too obvious. And make his accomplishment just slightly silly, so you can pass the information along with the right lightness of tone. Say he was a chemist and developed 106 industrial uses for lima bean oil. Number 6. Olive Oradell Entwistle. Grandmother on your father's side. Every fine family is leavened with a little bit of the artistic. Emphasis on the little bit. The stock artist character is an amateur thespian and great beauty whose father would not allow her to go on the stage professionally. This is good if you're a Hollywood type. You can tell how grandmother ran away to appear with the young Will Rogers in the Ziegfeld Follies, and how great-grandfather followed her to New York and walked out of the audience right up onto the stage in the middle of a chorus number, grabbed her by the arm, and took her home. But if you aspire to more elevated levels of society, make grandmother a New England poet, intimate of the Lowells, who never published and whose best work was destroyed by her mother for fear of scandal. A few poems survived, however, and were given to you when grandma was on her deathbed. Use the love poems of Robert Herrick. No one has read those in 100 years. Write them out in lavender ink on good stationery and leave the sheets in the sun for a month. Your new family tree. Have ye beheld with much delight a red rose peeping through a white? Or ever marked the pretty beam a strawberry shows half drowned in cream? So light to this, nay, all the rest, is each neat niplet of her breast. O-O-E. Very authentic, and almost as good for getting laid as a secret Negro. Number 7. Maudie O'Hanrahan, grandmother on your mother's side. The sins of yesterday are always enjoyed by the virtuous of today, so make Grandmother O'Hanrahan an old-fashioned dame de placer. This will give her, and by extension, you, a heart of gold. Tell your liberal friends about Grandma's angry views on the whole male sex and capitalism and imperialism besides. Tell your conservative friends she never regretted her naughty youth and carried a lock of King Victor Emmanuel's pubic hair to her grave. It is the essence of courtesy to be sympathetic to the largest possible number of people. Number 8. Orville Dodgson Interstate. Grandfather on your mother's side. Asphalt magnate and paving czar for whom Interstate 80 was named. No one will ever take your abilities seriously if there hasn't been some money in your family somewhere. People are suspicious of unrewarded virtue. If you aren't rich, say Grandpa Orville lost all his money in the Depression of 1921. It's a much more fashionable depression than the one in 1929. If you are rich, emphasize what a robber baron Grandpa was. Tell how he introduced anthrax into livery stables to boost the automobile trade, and how he dug up paupers' graves to get the calcium for blacktop manufacture. People are also suspicious of rewarded virtue. Number 9. Ed, your father's younger brother. He robbed a garage in Des Moines, lined up all the employees under a grease rack, and lowered an Oldsmobile on them. It's nice to have someone who is really bad, as opposed to sinful, in the family. It will make people think twice before they cross you in a business deal. Ed is also valuable if you want to affect the left-wing opinions, which are periodically fashionable among the overeducated. Turn the tables on Ed and Grandpa Luther and show how Ed was really performing an act of lumpen proletariat revolutionary violence, while Grandpa's supposed virtue only postponed the inevitable heightening of class contradictions, or whatever it is that pinky brains say these days. Number 10. Eileen, your mother's older sister. She has lived in Paris for 50 years and was close friends with Faulkner, Tristan Tzara, Dorothy Parker, and anyone else from the 20th century hip scene whose name you'd like to drop. In the popular imagination, everyone from D.H. Lawrence to Thelonious Monk lived together in a big motel room in downtown Paris from 1920 until the war in Vietnam. Eileen was involved in some terrible impropriety in Wherever You're From. Mom will not speak her name. She smokes opium and has Arab boy companions. Number 11. Mom and Dad. There's not much you can do with them. Try to give them an interesting past to make up for the dreary present, but remember to make the stories you tell about them the kind of stories they would be expected to deny. For instance, you can say that they abused you sexually. A claim of sexual abuse by a parent is also sufficient to excuse everything you do for the rest of your life. Optional relatives. Caution. Be sure you live far enough, both socially and geographically, from where you were born, to get away with imaginary immediate family members. Number 12. Cousin Zenobia, illegitimate daughter, or son, of your Aunt Eileen. This one's strictly for fun. She or he took your virginity when you were 12. Now he's a spy for the Mossad, but possibly a PLO double agent. He will add considerable spice to your stories about the European package tour. Number 13. Jane, your Mooney, EST nut, Jesus freak, etc. sister. Every well-off family in America has a kid like this, and it would be inconsiderate of you not to have one in your family. Tell how your father tried to have her deprogrammed, and after 28 hours in a motel room, Jane had converted a lawyer, two private detectives, and your mom. What to do about that name? There's a long tradition of silly names in polite society. Sir John Suckling, Millard Fillmore, Algernon Swinburne, Beer Bomb Tree, Armand Hammer, Pia Zadora, and so on. It's best to keep your own name, even if it's awful. Brazen it out like an Englishman would, and if anyone laughs, punch him like an American. It can even be an advantage to have a silly name if you're going into show business or such related fields as law and politics. If you don't have a bad name already, give yourself a terrible nickname. Dirty, Buggo, Weenie, and Blimp are good. They'll make you a character, and a character can get away with murder, or anyway, perjury, as Tricky Dick Nixon did. Still, it's hard to be the right sort of person if you're called Clement Squid or something, but this is easy to fix. An objectionable first name like Rufus, Melvin, Eustace, or Gladys can become an initial or two. Thus, the rather odd Ignatius Aloysius Connors becomes the perfectly normal I.A. Connors. Add a third initial from some family name for extra pizzazz, I.A.J. Connors. Adult last name can be improved by using your mother's maiden name. Bob Smith will never be remembered by anyone and looks like adultery when you sign a hotel register. But Williams Smith is very nice. Some ethnic groups, notably Central Europeans, have last names which sound very unfortunate in English. The usual approach is to shorten them. This wouldn't work with Schlumfuck or Lipbum, however. So an alternate strategy is to add ethnically compatible syllables. Schlumerfuckin-Stein or Lipperbummer-Man are almost ridiculous enough to make you a Habsburg prince. The most difficult last names are the simply foolish, e.g. Fink, Nertz, Stinkum, or Balls, and those which require constant explanation, e.g. Hitler or Mussolini. The trick here is to change the spelling and pronunciation in a small and natural way. There's nothing wrong with Frank, Neff, Stankin, Balsam, Hitner, or Mussoli. Try to be reasonably honest with your name change. It shouldn't look as though you're trying to pull something. Nowakowski can become Nowak, but not Norwalk. Pushkinikov can become Pushkin, but not Perkins. And use some logical occasion for your change of name. Going away to school, for instance, or enlisting in the army, or having your first business card or byline printed. Don't be shy about this. Ladies' man Gary Hartpence went so far as to run for president in order to have occasion to change his last name. Number 14. James, your older brother, deceased. If you want to be excused for all sorts of terrible behavior and don't have the heart to claim that your parents molested you, then tell how you suffered awful emotional trauma because of James. He was everything your parents ever wanted in a child. Handsome, smart, polite, popular, good at sports, and already accepted at Princeton in his junior year of high school. Then he stepped on a rusty croquet wicket and died from an allergic reaction to the tetanus shot. Of course, you were never able to live up to his example. Tell your friends that James used to torture animals and burgle neighborhood homes, but you've protected your parents from this knowledge all these years. Real families. Which sort is best? To become a mannerly and courteous person, you want only a few things from your real family. Dignity, breeding, and piles of money. That's all anyone has ever wanted from a family. But all anyone gets from most families is love. And family love has nothing to do with true love. Family love is messy, clinging, and of an annoying and repetitive pattern, like bad wallpaper. Are rich families better? Not necessarily, and especially not in America. The dignity evaporates when you discovered they made their fortune in dog laxatives. As for breeding, most rich people are too busy getting divorced and drinking to have time to show their sons how to tie a Windsor knot or tell their daughters never to marry a man with that knot in his tie. Rich children are shipped to boarding schools, often before they are weaned. It would be unfair to call the atmosphere in these schools bestial. A child who was kept in the Bronx Zoo for 12 years would acquire more courtesy and taste. Occasionally, boarding schools do turn out someone along the lines of the preppy stereotype, but in real life, their graduates are more likely to wind up playing electronic xylophone and singing 50s toothpaste commercials in a performance art ensemble. And when it comes to money, wealth does not guarantee it. Rich parents are famous both for miserliness and astonishing longevity. And when they finally do die, you'll find they've left their estate in inviolate trust to the golden retrievers. Are poor families any improvement? Poor families are much better. Of course, a poor family won't give you breeding, but it will give you preparation for life. It's far more instructive to have a drunk parent right there in the tenement with you than it is to have a drunk parent off in Gstaad. Poor families also scream at each other, never have spending money, and are prone to violence. This is excellent preparation for becoming, say, president of a large corporation, what with acrimonious board meetings, constant cash flow problems, and corporate products that maim and kill people. In fact, being poor is generally much better for getting rich than being rich is. Poor people have a lot of time on their hands and spend it thinking up inexpensive and easily marketed fads like crack. There is also dignity in being poor. A poor person who has made even slightly good is more admired than a rich person who has been only slightly bad. We are, after all, a nation of immigrants, laborers, common men. In our popular mythology, the lower classes are decent, hard-working, and possessed of simple piety and common sense, as long as they stay downwind. Your proletarian dignity, however, will do no good when your alcoholic bag lady mother comes looking for you in the Four Seasons. What about middle-class families? Most of us don't have the luck to be either rich or poor. We are stuck instead with being embarrassed. There's tiresome dad with his mailman shoes and his job selling wholesale something, and out of it mom with her Mrs. George Bush hair and the pseudo-colonial ranch in Dayton Acres with a Chevrolet Celebrity in the attached garage. The only possible thing you can do with a family like this is kill them. You'll probably get out of the mental hospital in 5 or 6 years. And when you do, there'll be a fat book contract waiting. Tell your ghostwriter, I did it because of the pole lamps. Every sensitive person will understand. 3. The Fundamentals of Contemporary Courtesy. Good breeding consists in concealing how much we think of ourselves and how little we think of the other person. Samuel Clemens. The purpose of old-fashioned manners was to avoid attracting attention. The reason for this was that old-fashioned manners were possessed by only a few hundred rich people. These few hundred rich people didn't want all the hundreds of millions of poor people to notice who had the money. If the rich, polite few started attracting attention, the poor, rude many might get together and commit mayhem the way they did in Russia. The heck with that, said rich people. But nowadays there are hundreds of millions of rich people, and poor people have been pretty much rendered harmless by drugs and sleeping on sidewalks. Plus, it's getting so you can't tell rich from poor anyway, what with Nigerian illegal immigrants selling Rolexes on street corners and Gloria Vanderbilt putting her name on blue jean behinds. The problem modern people have is trying to be special. Therefore, the purpose of modern manners is to attract as much attention as possible. Greetings. The importance of conspicuousness in modern life has led to the phenomenon of greeting inflation. Once, even the closest friends greeted each other with a polite bow. Today, such reticence is almost extinct. A loud, sweetheart, a slap on the back, chuck on the arm, tousling of hair, and a cheerful have a nice day will do if you don't know a person at all. But if you have even the slightest acquaintance with someone, it is usual to embrace him physically, no matter what the circumstances. If you're carrying a briefcase or package, just throw it into the gutter. This makes a dramatic gesture of good fellowship. If you actually know someone's name, twin kisses on both cheeks are expected, and should be accompanied by some highly original term of endearment. I love you, or you're my best friend, isn't nearly strong enough. In California, where manners are more modern than anywhere else, people say, I'd murder my parents to have lunch with you, or even, I'm so glad to see you that I'm going to give you gross points in my new movie. The latter statement is a lie, by the way. Rebuffs. At one time, there was not only an etiquette of greeting people, but also an etiquette of not greeting them. This ranged in degree from the coldly formal bow to the cut direct. The cut direct was delivered by looking right at a person and not acknowledging his acquaintance or even his existence. This is no longer done. It has been replaced by the lawsuit. Opposing parties in a lawsuit, and other enemies, are expected to greet each other like lovers, especially now when it's so fashionable for hostesses to invite people who hate each other to the same dinners. If the enmity is minor or philosophical in nature, argument or, better, tableware throwing may resume after a drink or two. But if the hatred is deep and well-occasioned, the mutual detesters are expected to chat amicably throughout the evening. Hat, cane, and gloves. What to do with your hat and cane is a perennial awkwardness when greeting people. If the cane is necessary, it should be replaced with a crutch, which will gain you much more sympathy. A hat should be taken off when you greet a lady, and left off for the rest of your life. Nothing looks more stupid than a hat. When you put on a hat, you are surrendering to the same urge that makes children wear mouse ears at Disney World, or drunks wear lampshades at parties. Wearing a hat implies that you are bald if you are a man, and that your hair is dirty if you are a woman. Every style of hat is identified with some form of undesirable. Derby equals corrupt ward healer. Fedora, male model. Top hat, rich bum. Pillbox, Kennedy wife, etc. Furthermore, the head is symbolically identified with the sexual organs, so that when you walk down the street wearing a hat, anyone who has the least knowledge of psychology will see you as having a problem. A hat should only be worn if you are employed as a baseball player or are hunting ducks in the rain. Gloves present another problem, especially when shaking hands. Men must always remove their gloves before a handshake. There's a good reason for this. A man can be very accurately judged by his hand. A soft hand indicates a lazy, unemployed person. A hard, calloused hand shows that a person is an ignorant and dull manual laborer. A cold, clammy hand means that a person is guilty and nervous. And a warm, dry hand means a person is incapable of feeling guilt and has the nerve to pull anything on you. A woman never removes her gloves. There's a good reason for this, too. A woman can also be very accurately judged by her hand. And why would she want to be? The handshake. Despite the popularity of more effusive forms of greeting, the handshake is omnipresent. It is now extended to everyone, men, women, old people, young children, and especially pet dogs. It's important to develop a limp and affected handshake. A firm, hearty handshake gives a good first impression, and you'll never be forgiven if you don't live up to it. Also, a firm, hearty handshake inspires confidence in others. People who go around inspiring confidence in others are probably looking to sell them something. You don't want to appear to be that sort. Farewells. Much more important than greeting people is saying goodbye to them, or getting them to say goodbye to you, or getting rid of them somehow anyway. The one thing that can be safely said about the great majority of people is that we don't want them around. Be sincere and forthright about the problem. Take the person you want to get rid of aside and tell him he has to leave because the people you're with hate him. Say, "I'm sorry, Fred, but you can't sit down with us. Molly and Bill Dinnersworth hate you because you're so much smarter and more successful than they are." This is nasty and flattering at the same time, and it makes life more interesting, which, if you're too sophisticated to just want attention, is the point of existence. In public. If you don't manage to get rid of everyone and end up having to go somewhere with a group of people, make sure the couples are separated and that each partner is escorted by somebody new. This will give everyone something different to fight about later. Generally speaking, a man is supposed to walk to the left of a woman and also keep himself between her and the curb. Of course, it is frequently impossible to do both, but the great thinkers of all ages have been unanimous in their admiration of paradoxes. Unless he is helping her into an ambulance or a paddy wagon, a man is never supposed to touch a woman in public. That is, he shouldn't if he's married to the woman. Nothing is more deleterious to the spirit of romance than watching a married couple hold hands. If a man is walking down the street with two women, he should keep them both on his right and not appear between them like an acrobat taking a bow. Every authority on etiquette mentions this precept. But what no authority on etiquette mentions is how a man can manage to get two women in the first place. The best idea is for him to convince his wife or girlfriend to talk a friend of hers into a threesome. Most likely the result will be physically and emotionally disastrous. But everyone will get something juicy to tell the psychiatrist and something to romanticize in diary or memoirs. Again, life is made more interesting. It's no longer de rigueur for a man to burden himself with anything heavy that a woman is carrying, especially not a mortgage or someone else's baby. Nor should a man necessarily hold a door for a woman, unless it is a revolving door. It's not good manners to hold a revolving door, but it is lots of fun when other people are trapped inside. Restaurants, taxicabs, and the theater. When entering a restaurant, a man should allow the woman to precede him to their seats. This lets her find a friend whose table she can stand at and chat for half an hour, while the man gets a chance to glimpse the prices on the menu and has a clear shot to bolt for the door when he sees those prices. A wise woman allows a man to enter a taxicab ahead of her, so she can slam his hand in the door if he's been acting like an ass. At the theater, concert, or ballet, a man allows a woman to take her seat first. He then holds her coat on his lap along with his own coat, her purse, her umbrella, both programs, and any other personal effects. Safely hidden behind this mound of belongings, he can go to sleep. The importance of being on time. Whatever type of event you're attending, it's important to be on time. Being on time should not be confused with being prompt. Being prompt means arriving at the beginning. Being on time means arriving at the most interesting moment. Excepting love affairs, that moment is rarely the beginning. On time is between midnight and 4 a.m. in New York, even for an 8 o'clock play. Between midnight and 4 a.m., the actors will be getting drunk in a bar, and they'll be much more fun to talk to than when they're up on the stage. In most other urban areas, on time is between 20 minutes and an hour late. This gives everyone else time to be late too, and they'll appreciate it. In the country, being on time more nearly approximates being prompt, but don't overdo it. Being early is an unpardonable sin. If you are early, you'll witness the last-minute confusion and panic that always attend making anything seem effortlessly gracious. In California, on time doesn't mean anything at all. An appointment for a meeting at 3 o'clock on Tuesday indicates there won't be a meeting, and there might not be a Tuesday. Few words and no numbers have any meaning west of the Nevada border. At home. One popular way to avoid the problem of being on time is to stay at home and conduct your life over the telephone. This is very chic in New York. Even New Yorkers who occasionally go outdoors have taken to telephoning every person they know once a day, and twice if any of them has anything awful to say about the others. Living over the telephone has a number of advantages. It saves on cab fare and clothing budgets, and love affairs can be conducted without the bother of contraception or hairdressers. In fact, with judicious use of answering machines, a love affair can be conducted without the bother of ever talking to the loved one. Making up in public. It's bad manners to apply cosmetics in public. It reminds people that you need them. Code of a Modern Gentleman. Number 1. Never strike anyone so old, small, or weak that verbal abuse would have sufficed. Number 2. Never steal anything so small that you'll have to go to an unpleasant city jail for it instead of a minimum security federal tennis prison. Number 3. Remember, the truth is rude. Consider the truth about where babies come from, especially some people's. Number 4. Never be unfaithful to a lover, except with your wife. Number 5. Never transmit a sexual disease in public. Number 6. Women and children should be protected in every tax-deductible way. Number 7. Don't pull on a crewneck sweater with a lit cigarette in your mouth. Smoking in public. Smoking was once subject to all sorts of polite restrictions, but now it's just illegal. Therefore, there's only one remaining rule of etiquette about smoking in public. Make sure you don't smoke anywhere else. Smoking is an inexpensive and convenient means of showing fashionable contempt for middle-class rules and regulations. Smoking also looks good. People who don't smoke have a terrible time finding something polite to do with their lips. But when no one's around to see you, it doesn't matter what you do, so there's no point in smoking then. If someone asks you not to smoke, tell him you have no intentions of living to be an embittered old person, but thank him for his concern. Nonchalance. Nonchalance about health and well-being is what gives smoking its charm. That same nonchalance is at the heart of all really good manners. The most fundamental lesson of etiquette is to be unconcerned. Proper behavior means always giving the appearance of unperturbed grace. This appearance is much easier to achieve if you really don't care about anything. And this is why people always seem to be on their best behavior right before they commit suicide. 4. Important people. When to stand up, when to sit down, and when to roll over and play dead. Of beasts, it is confessed the ape comes nearest us in human shape. Like man, he imitates each fashion, and malice is his ruling passion. But both in malice and grimaces, a courtier any ape surpasses. Oliver Goldsmith. An important person should be treated exactly like anyone else holding a gun at your head. Fortunately, there aren't many important people. To be important, a person must be able to have an effect on your life. But the anarchy, entropy, and confusion in what's left of Western civilization make it difficult for anyone to have any effect on anything. Therefore, this chapter is about people who are called important rather than people who are important. The head waiter at Ma Maison, IRS auditors, and your immediate superior at work are important enough to be treated under separate headings. People who are important to me. Some people who are called important are the to me kind of important, as in, my parents are important to me. If it is necessary to explain that someone is important to you, that explanation is all you are socially obligated to do for him. He isn't that important. Famous people. Other people who are called important are actually famous. Of course, they aren't important either, and it would be hard to think of anything less important than some of them. A lamprey is more important than Bianca Jagger. But it is not a lie to call famous people important because it isn't they to whom we are referring. It's their fame. Fame is very important. Modern society is without any concept of dignity, worth, or regard. Today, the only thing which sets one person apart from another is his or her degree of fame. Social obligations to the modern or famous type of important people are enormous and complex. We must be as obsequious as possible to famous people and do everything in our power to make them like us. Fame is a communicable disease, and if you kiss the ass of someone who's got it, you may catch it yourself. Introductions. In order to meet famous people and give them the opportunity to take advantage of you, an introduction is necessary. Asking for their autograph or running up to their restaurant table and gushing over their latest cause for notoriety, "I loved your divorce," won't do. The perfectly correct and most formal introduction is, "Mr. Awfulpicks, may I present Mr. Climby?" Or, "Mr. Grosspoints, may I present you to Miss Bettable?" Or use the word introduce instead of present. It's almost as correct and not as stupid sounding. The less famous person is presented to the more famous person. But men are always presented to women, no matter how many times the man has appeared on the cover of Time, and no matter how obvious it is that the woman wants to sleep with him just because he has. The only circumstance in which a woman is presented to a man is if that man is President of the United States. And who'd want to sleep with him? Children. Children are never introduced at all unless the famous person has a thing for them, and you have one paid for and ready at the time. Subfamous people. Of course, the very formal method of introduction is never used by sophisticated people because sophisticated people have never had occasion to read a book of etiquette. Besides, most of them know each other already. But it is wise to use the most ceremonious forms with people such as game show hosts, rock star wives, daytime television personalities, Cher's boyfriends, and others who might be insecure about their social status because they have none. Otherwise, introductions are tailored to the circumstances and to the amount of fame involved. If there's no fame involved, and you're just introducing one worthless friend of yours to another, you can say simply, "Don't you guys know each other?" and walk away. Insignificant friends. When you want to introduce an insignificant friend to a famous person, you probably don't really want to at all. It's hard to do what you really want all the time, but like every difficult task, it results in a feeling of great accomplishment and satisfaction. Just leave your friend standing there like furniture while you chat happily with the MTV VJ, mafia hitman, or elected official. If you owe money to the friend or are married to him or her, and taking this tack will get you in trouble, you can say, "Oh, by the way, Mr. Panflash, this is Alice. We went to the same child psychiatrist back in Lake Forest." If you have an ancient acquaintance with someone not worth knowing, most people will at least pretend to forgive you, the way they would pretend to forgive you for a birth defect or the wrong racial background. Of course, your spouse, whom you met 2 weeks ago in a health club, may be perplexed by this explanation, but that's what your spouse gets for trying to marry up. Ambitious friends. Introducing an ambitious friend to a famous person is more tricky. It's not done unless the friend is so ambitious that he might be of use to you someday. Ambitious people are a lot more annoying than worthless people. Strategically, you don't want to alienate the friend, but tactically, you don't want to be remembered for foisting that friend on your famous acquaintance. Say, "Mrs. Greed Agent, this is my friend Mark. He's involved in a lot of really interesting cable TV projects." You've used the phrase cable TV projects, international code words for unemployed and on the make, so the celebrity cannot claim she wasn't warned. Change cable TV projects to video art if you think it will be a really long, long time before your friend is famous himself. When two people are both important. Introducing important people to each other is much more satisfying than introducing them to video artists. One approach is to do everything you can to make them attractive to each other and hope that you will receive a sort of social finder's fee if they hit it off. They won't. The social habits of famous people are like the sexual practices of porcupines, which urinate on each other to soften the quills. A more interesting thing to do is to make sure the two important people loathe each other right from the start. On A Plotless, this is Brett lead part. Brett thinks your novels are very good, of their kind. Brett, Anna has told me that she's heard you're very famous in Japan. This way you'll become the conduit for all sorts of wonderful maliciousness between these two august souls. When one person is important and the other person is interesting. The most delightful introduction you can make is to introduce an important person to someone he or she is going to find sexually interesting. This introduction is made in two parts. First, you prep the sex object. Kiki, save the jugs for later. I'm going to introduce you to Antonio. Antonio is a famous photographer. Yes, he does lots of fashion. Paris Vogue. Then you march Kiki over to your well-known friend. Antonio, you're going to love this girl. She once made Warren Beatty bleed out the ears. Kiki's name is not a necessary part of the transaction. Introducing yourself. There is only one person you can never introduce to the famous, and that is yourself. Therefore, it's good to cultivate the affections of professional sycophants, such as publicists, movie agents, and freelance writers for Vanity Fair magazine. These people are understandably short of friends, and if you are kind to them, they'll let you get the benefit of celebrity acquaintance while they do the fawning and toadying necessary for such acquaintance to be achieved. Making famous people comfortable. Once you've met a famous person, say something that will make you remembered. Cornelia Guest. Oh, my gosh, Miss Guest, I know it's polite for a gentleman to remove his hat when he meets a lady, but for you, I feel I should do something more, like take off my pants. Then shut up. Famous people think they want to be treated like regular people. This is not true. Famous people also think they are special and wonderful. This is even less true. The best course of action is to go ahead and treat them as if they are ordinary, because boy, are they ever. But now and then throw something into the conversation to show that you share their completely wrong-headed opinion of their own wonderfulness. Gosh, Cornelia, you make liposuction come alive. When the famous person you've met is not in your immediate company, ignore him or her completely. This is the modern use of the cut direct mentioned in Chapter 3. Whereas in former times the cut direct was used on enemies, it has now evolved into a polite way to show respect for famous friends. It is an article of faith among celebrities that they are constantly pestered by the public. Of course, there are so many celebrities and so few of them are celebrated for anything that most of the time the public can't be bothered. But it's only common courtesy to act as though the famous people you know are so famous that the public is very bothered indeed. You don't want to be seen as part of that public. Wait for the celebrities to pester you. They will soon enough. If they weren't infantile, self-obsessed hogs for attention, then our kind of society never would have thought they were important in the first place. 5. Table manners. Put not another bit into your mouth till the former be swallowed. Cleanse not your teeth with the tablecloth, napkin, or fork or knife. Spit not in the fire. Kill no vermin as fleas, lice, ticks, and set in the sight of others. George Washington, age 15, Rules of Civility. Table manners are a test to see whether you're acting like a beast because you're rudely ignorant or acting like a beast because you're fashionably amusing. Fashionably amusing table manners are a matter of breaking the right rule at the right time. Dinner parties. Arrival. It isn't necessary to arrive at a dinner party any later than extremely late as usual. Unless you have acquired a scandalous new dress, or a black eye from a famous lover, or something else that demands an entrance. In that case, it's incumbent upon you to arrive after everyone else is seated. A hostess will wait for a tardy guest, 10 minutes for a man, 15 minutes for a woman, and half an hour for someone with a scandalous new dress or a black eye from a famous lover. Do not apologize for being late, especially not in a timid or embarrassed manner. A show of rudeness is quickly forgotten, but a show of cowardice never is.